Welcome to the Book Show, and tonight we speak to Philip Hensher about the Penguin Book of the British Short Story and hear from Kai Miller about maps, Jamaican patois and hurricanes. But first, joining me from a London studio is Lionel Shriver. She's probably best known for her Orange Prize winning book, We Need to Talk About Kevin, and has written on many subjects from obesity to motherhood. She has now turned to projection and predictions for the future in The Mandibles. It's a family story set in the near future when the US is in financial meltdown and one previously wealthy family, The Mandibles, is feeling the brunt of it. Here's Lionel Shriver reading from the novel, and at this point, one of the family, Nolly, is explaining how collapse can come about.
The national debt was bound to come to a head eventually. Nolly held forth on her third glass of wine. It was just hard to predict when. Familiar with complexity theory. It helps to explain why everything can be fine for a long time and then go to hell all at once. Complexity theory isn't itself all that complex, Nolly said pleasantly, not rising to the bait. As systems become more complex, they grow exponentially more unstable. They can keep puttering along, getting messier and messier, until one tiny disturbance sends the whole shebang into meltdown. Like those towers of playing cards, where you add a single queen of hearts and suddenly it's 52 pickup. Or jugglers who can keep 10 balls in the air but not 11. Feeding, watering, and employing 9 billion people and rising is the ultimate complex system. You never know when adding that one last baby boy sends all the balls in the air to the floor.
So in this book, the world is in free fall, but what happens specifically to the Mandibles to kind of, you know, throw them from being, you know, they're sleeping on 650 thread count sheets to four generations all piled into one apartment or house. They're literally sharing mattresses on the floor. So what's happened?
Well, we're all living at various economic levels, but they were, you know, everyone was surviving and they were hoping to better than survive because their 97-year-old patriarch is quite wealthy. He inherited a family fortune from two generations before him. And if he would only hurry up and die already, then everybody would be quite comfortable. But then the economy of the United States collapses, which is a lot of the story of the book, and the fortune is no more.
It's hard to kind of pick out a central character or protagonist, but there's a really intriguing young man called Willing, who's almost the closest to maybe a bit of a hero that the book, if the book even has one. Tell me about him.
Well, Willing is my favorite character, so I'm glad you like him. And he's definitely the hero, or what I would say, he's a stealth hero. He emerges in the book very gradually, and you're not necessarily meant to spot that he will become your protagonist. He is only 13 years old when the book begins and is very serious, a little odd, keeps to himself, but is clearly precocious, especially when it comes to economics. So he becomes a shameless vehicle for the book and the author to be able to convey some sometimes seemingly complex concepts that aren't as complicated as they might appear.
I'm guessing that this book will be pulled out over the next few decades. And I'm wondering, was there any kind of book that you found eerily prescient as to what the future or the now would be like?
Well, you know, there have been lots of dystopian novels. Many of them, some of the early ones, were obsessed with climate change and rising sea levels. There was a book called The Drowned World in 1962.
J.G. Ballard.
Yes. And, you know, that's all about sea level rise. And I think that's the one in which London is underwater. And that, it's quite prescient for the time. Admirably so. And there was also a whole raft of novels in the 60s about population growth and dystopic futures in which there were way too many people, and it created a Darwinian survival of the fittest. And again, you know, while the numbers that were predicted round about the Paul Ehrlich era of the population bomb have not come to pass. It's still a big issue, and it's one that we've started to revisit because a few years ago, the UN stopped revising their estimates for our peak population mid-century downward and started revising them upward again. And so we were going to reach 9 billion. Now it's looking like at least 10.2. And, you know, that's reality. That's not fiction. And it means feeding and finding the fresh water for about 50% more people than we have now in very short order. And I find that frightening.
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, the Mandibles is fiction, but is it also a warning to us in the present to get our priorities right?
Oh, I think that's the nature of dystopic fiction in general.
Yeah.
That it's trying to serve as a cautionary tale. This is what happens if you don't do anything. Now, the odd thing in relation to population is that to a very great degree, that is already a done deal. That's the nature of age structure. And unless you have a plague that wipes out half of the human race, and that's my fourth novel. there's not a whole lot you can do about it.
But in The Mandibles, you've inverted the notion of the wall between the US and Mexico, in that when the US collapses, it's Mexico that will build the wall. And I'm wondering, as we're talking about the future, in the very immediate future, do you think it's possible that Donald Trump could be running the US next year?
I don't. Okay. All things are possible, and you can come back to me later and say, but you lied. I don't think he's going to be elected president. My countrymen are not quite that crazy. But it was funny for me in the novel, which I wrote before he became a serious candidate for the Republican nomination, to have written about this wall that Mexico erects voluntarily, I might add, not being bullied into it, but it's to keep the Americans out.
He's also, I mean, when you write about the Republican Party in the novel, it's a party with no credibility. And do you think that Trump, you know, has destroyed the Republican Party, or is, you know, is more of this type of politics on the way in the future?
I think he's doing the Republican Party great damage. I think there's a danger of a split that might last. And again, I seem to be barely ahead of the curve, because in my 2029 in The Mandibles, the Republican Party has become kind of a joke. You know, it's just a small crowd of old white people. And it no longer seriously represents the country. And it is suggested in the novel that, therefore, the U.S. has become a one-party state, effectively.
Yeah.
And that's not especially good for the country. And I don't think it is. And therefore, I am a Democrat, but I want a viable Republican Party, and I don't think it's good for the U.S. to have the Democrats in permanent control.
Yeah, I think everybody would agree with that, a lot of people. I just want to change tack for a moment. We need to talk about Kevin. There was considerable credit given to your book as a way for people to talk about social and mental health issues, particularly with problem teenagers. And I'm wondering, do you think we talk enough about the probability of total collapse, and does anyone care to listen?
You know, part of what this kind of fiction does is explore our anxieties. I mean, you know, I can warn you about the problems of escalating debt. I'm not sure how much difference it makes to the real world, but I think it's comforting in a strange way to be able to exercise your fears. And it is to me. I mean, it's my way of coping, and I think readers cope in the same way, by giving their fears expression. My main goal with this book was to control the scale. And I think that's one of the reasons the book is a little more unnerving than it might otherwise be. That is, it's on a modest lifetime scale. It's not about planets exploding or asteroids running into the Earth, or we're not descended into animals and murdering each other in massive gangs. It's not Mad Max. Not that much has changed. It's only 13 years from now when the book starts. So it's meant to seem more or less familiar, and therefore it seems a little more threatening because you can imagine yourself going through it.
Lowell in the book says at one point, the future is the ultimate monster in the closet. And if Donald Trump is not going to be president, is Hillary Clinton, and is she the answer? Is she going to fix things?
You know, I don't have a great deal of faith in Hillary Clinton. She's not really a visionary. I imagine she'll keep our act together to the best of her ability. She's a moderate politician. She's not likely to do anything overtly crazy. And at this point, that's really all I ask.
That's a great note to end on. It was brilliant to speak to you. Thanks, Lila Schreiber.
It was really nice to talk to you too.
The Mandibles, A Family, 2029 to 2047, is published by the Borough Press. Now, Kai Miller's 2014 collection, The Cartographer Tries to Map a Way to Zion, brings together two cultures and types of knowledge. They're represented by the figures of the Western cartographer and the Jamaican rasterman in conversation with each other. He started by sharing a memory of his youth in Jamaica and the sweeping change of culture that was felt like a hurricane.
I do remember when the colour TV came. I remember satellite dishes in particular. You know, literally we were, you know, the world was coming in. It was a huge status symbol, you know, if you had a satellite dish or not. And the big hurricane that I lived through, Hurricane Gilbert in 1988, all the satellite dishes became flying saucers, and they were just, all of them became dislodged and were just kind of flying through the air. And it was, you know, the great devastation of the hurricane was that it blew off all the satellite dishes. And so it was this moment where, yes, a kind of modernity had come, and the hurricane, this, you know, this most native force of the Caribbean came and blew them all away and kind of, you know, plunged the whole island back into darkness, literally into darkness for about 2 months.
Dish take off like fine salsa. Me roof migrate without a visa.
Then when we didn't have electricity and we didn't have satellite dishes, the generator became a new status symbol, because you had to have money to afford a generator to have electricity in your house. And, you know, and there were bizarre things that happened in the island at that time. I remember my neighbors would turn on their lawnmower during the night because it sounded like a generator. And, you know, people would think that, oh, they're of a class that can afford a generator. The Cartographer Tries to Map a Way to Zion 1, in which the cartographer explains himself. You might say my job is not to lose myself exactly, but to imagine what loss might feel like. The sudden creeping pace, the consultation with trees and blue fences and whatever else might prove a landmark, my job is to imagine the widening of the unfamiliar and also the widening ache of it. To anticipate the ironic question, how did we find ourselves here? My job is to untangle the tangled, to unworry the concerned, to guide you out from cul-de-sacs into which you may have wrongly turned. Now you have these two figures, you have the Rastaman and you have the cartographer. When I read it in the UK, everyone assumes that I draw a lot on my own life when I represent the Rastaman. And I do throw clues in there to tempt the reader to think that I am the Rastaman. But when I read the collection in Jamaica, it becomes more obvious to everyone there that I'm the cartographer. That really is the fascinating thing about living in a place like Jamaica, getting a colonial education. You learn very deeply how to mistrust parts of yourself, how to dismiss parts of your knowledge. Two, in which the Rastaman disagrees. Now, the Rastaman has another reasoning. He says, that man's job is never straightforward or easy. Him work is to make thin and crushable all that is big and as real as ourselves, is to make flat all that is high and rolling, is to make invisible and worthless plenty things that poor people can't do without, like board houses or the corner shop from which Miss Katie sell our famous peanut porridge. And then again, the map maker's work is to make visible all them things that should have never exist in the first place, like the conquest of pirates, like borders, like the viral spread of governments. one teacher told us that, you know, that the iambic pentameter is the most natural rhythm because it was the rhythm of the heart. And even then I thought, that's such bullcrap. I was trying to imagine someone with a stethoscope, you know, putting it to someone's heart and it literally going da-dum, da-dum, da-dum. But I thought that's what cultures need to do. Cultures need to explain or validate their own rhythms by giving it residence in the heart to act as if it is natural and it's inherent and it comes from us. In Rastafari culture in Jamaica, what we call a Naya Bingi beat, which is doop 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 doop, you know, it's what Bob Marley sings. I hear the words. You know, it's a very famous rhythm, but that's called a heartbeat rhythm as well. And I thought, wow, you know, here are these two wildly different rhythms. Again, just like this fascination of things that come from two totally different places, but both of them were claiming residence in the heart. I guess I was trying to have a conversation or extend a conversation that started with Kamau Brathwaite, who, a very famous Caribbean poet, who once said in an essay, you know, what we've inherited in Caribbean poetics is the pentameter, but the problem is the hurricane does not roar in pentameters. And so there's an early poem that says, you know, how do you capture the rhythm of the hurricane or the meter of the hurricane? And so, you know, a lot of the collection is... it's just fascinated by that question. What would that meter be? How do you find it? How do you find a meter for a new landscape, that especially in a place like the Caribbean, because it's a coming together of so many cultures, that the rhythm has to be various. It can never be perfect. It has to have dissonance. It has to interrupt itself and, you know, destabilize itself all the time. But in that clashing can come a kind of harmony.
The Cartographer Tries to Map a Way to Zion by Kai Miller is published by Carcanet. Now, finally this evening, Philip Hensher is a British novelist and short story writer. His novel, The Northern Clemency, was shortlisted for the 2008 Man Booker Prize. And late last year, Hensher edited The Penguin Book of the British Short Story. This two-volume collection brings the reader from Daniel Defoe to Zadie Smith via a host of both household names and many long-lost writers. A project like this always raises the obvious issue of who to include and who to leave out. And what exactly is British, anyway? I put these questions to Philip Hensher when I met him to discuss the anthology, but I had to ask him, how on earth did he set about his daunting task?
I thought of every author that I could possibly think of who ever written short stories. I read all their short stories. And then I wanted to read through magazines.
You say in the introduction as well that you read 20,000 stories.
I don't know that it was... The 20,000 is an accurate figure, but it can't have been short of that. I wouldn't have thought putting it like that makes it sound like hard work. It was an absolute joy, you know, to get up in the morning and think, I've got nothing to do all day but read short stories. It was wonderful.
Slightly contradicts Mavis Gallant, famously said that you should read one story a day and close the book. Not when you're putting an anthology together, mind. The title of the book is the British short story, obviously. And this is a very broad term, as we know. But you say that you included writers here who seem to contribute to the British short story rather than belong to it. So what did you mean and who did you mean?
Well, I mean, the British have got such a bad habit, really, of claiming people for their own that I didn't want to make the, you know, lazy assumption that, you know, Catherine Mansfield is British when, you know, New Zealanders feel very strongly about her. And I put Jean Reason, who was born in Dominica, put V.S. Naipaul in, who's such an important figure in British literature. And one of the very important people that I put in was a writer called Samuel Selvan, who is of that Windrush generation. He was really the first generation of immigrants from the Caribbean. And I wanted to put him in partly because I thought that was such an important part of the British story. Partly because, you know, one of the really key things is a writer reporting on an aspect of experience that is maybe quite marginal at the time.
On the inclusion of Irish writers, you say you would have been happy to include them up to 1922, but wouldn't have put Joyce in necessarily. But you do include Elizabeth Bowen.
I do. I know it's inconsistent, but Elizabeth Bowen, yes, it's. I can't defend it. It's not really like the rules of a competition, but because so much of her most important work was set in England, and because she always thought of herself as Anglo-Irish, and it seemed to me that her important connections were with people like Elizabeth Taylor. You know, I thought that maybe she could be justified. I don't know, but I'm very happy if she appears in Two Nations anthologies.
You mentioned magazines, and there's a sense that in a very particular era, they were a place for breaking new names, they were a place for established people to sort of earn a living as a writer. How important were they for you in terms of finding the work, and what was their significance at the time?
Well, the significance was really impressive. There were 34 full-time magazines in London between the 1890s and the First World War, publishing short fiction. And it's really the period between the creation of a huge reading audience by universal education and the invention of the cinema. And in that 25 years, what they were most interested in was reading books and reading magazines. And they paid, by our standards, enormous sums of money for short stories. I mean, you know, Conan Doyle became rich on the proceeds of the Sherlock Holmes stories. So authors invested a lot of their energies in creating a beautiful, perfect short story. It was a very important outlet for them, in much the same way that authors now might invest a lot of their energy in writing a screenplay. They published not only stories from the outskirts of society, but very eccentric and experimental short stories. And there's cases like H.G. Wells, who when he first starts publishing, he's supplying the bizarre little scientific fantasy at the back of a magazine that some editor has just thought, well, let's give it a go. In a few years, he's the star name at the front of the magazine who, you know, if you put new story by H.G. Wells, then probably another 5,000 people are going to buy your magazine.
Did you find as you were compiling these stories that in terms of ethnicity and diversity that you were watching out and that you were making sure the book was as broad and as expansive as it could be?
I don't think I was. I had that as an instruction in mind. But one of the things that I did discover, much to my surprise actually, was that from very early on, because most of these stories were published in magazines, that it was very easy for the editor of a magazine to find space for a two or three page story from somebody from the real margins of society. You know, in the 1880s, we've got stories by recent Jewish immigrants from Russia, but also people from the margins of society in other ways. Working class writers could always find a way to edge into print to earn, you know, a couple of pounds maybe with a short story in the 1890s. And interestingly, you very often find short stories by gay men and lesbians, even from, you know, the 1890s onwards, sometimes surprisingly frank about what's going on, considering that, you know, they're writing about illegal things. So at the end, I was aware that it was probably covering a bit more of the ground than most anthologies do.
The question that every anthologist hates is omission. And how to decide what to leave out, what to put in. And people will always, you won't be able to please everybody, so people complain. So are there people here who you feel are missing?
Yes, of course. I mean, I've got, you know, 90 names, but, you know, it could very easily have been twice the length. It really could. There were, you know, particularly with living writers, I wanted to have a proper reading experience for somebody who'd bought the anthology, not just to put in stuff that I'd been told 100 times was really excellent, even though I didn't feel passionately about it myself. I had a little mantra that I kept saying to myself, I am writing an anthology, I am putting together an anthology, I am not writing an encyclopedia. It would have been very easy indeed to have put together an anthology of people that everybody had heard of, but I would have lost working class writers, I would have lost those important marginal voices, I would have lost a lot of eccentricity. It would have been conventional, mainstream, and it was very, very difficult.
And the Penguin Book of the British Short Story is published by Penguin. Philip Hensher's latest collection of short stories, Tales of Persuasion, is published by Fourth Estate. Well, that's all we've time for this evening. We'll be back with this season of The Book Show in September. So until then, keep in touch on Twitter at BookshowRTE. The producer is Regan Hutchins, and the series producer is Zoe Cummins.